Matt Segundo here, and I'm pleased to steer this steady ship away from the Bolsheviks. Michael Martone was the worst of all. What kind of arrogant bastard do you have to be to name a book after your own name? I mean, it's almost like naming a radio show after your name. Bad example, but I'm sure you see my point. Anyway, this week's guest is Jonathan Safran Foer, a man who refuses to be addressed as John, Johnny, or even John Boy or Johnny Baby. He's a formal kid, this Foer. Only Jonathan will do. And our young roving correspondent proved equally tongue-tied when he talked with him earlier this year.
So I am here in an effort to sort of talk with all literary Jonathans. I have with me Jonathan Safran Foer, who is the author of Everything is Illuminated, as well as Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Jonathan, how are you doing?
Doing well. Doing very well, actually. I love San Francisco, so happy to be here.
How many times have you been here?
Many, many.
Okay.
Two of my best friends live here.
Oh, okay.
So I've visited them a number of times, and it's the kind of place one happens to be a lot.
Gotcha. Well, it's sort of like a mini New York, as John Lennon described it.
It's not like New York at all.
Well, it's a mini New York.
Well, in addition to being smaller, it's also a lot more natural.
Yeah.
You know, it has a feel of... First of all, it's a lot more liberal in every way, and you can just feel that walking around.
Really?
Yeah, oh, God, yeah. New York is not a liberal place anymore.
Hmm.
New York is a financial place.
Yeah.
But also, you know... Just the food is more natural here. Conversation seems to run more naturally here. Mm-hmm. People are outside more often.
Mm-hmm.
It's a healthier place, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but is what it is.
It's always good to be on edge, though, maybe a little bit. Maybe we're a little too laid back out here. I don't know.
I don't know. You seem to be getting enough done.
True. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and get right into your work. I wanted to, first of all, talk about the fact that you use a good deal of stylistic techniques. I wanted to sort of ask you, what do you find real in your books as a writer, given that there's a lot of, you know, in the first book, time shifting, in the second book, a lot of additional sort of style that you've used. Maybe you can sort of describe this as the sort of general question that you've probably been asked at least 10 times.
Well, I'll never quite like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange that we think of things like time shifting as style.
Yeah.
When... I've never experienced a day of my life that didn't include something like time shifting, whether it's something simple like looking at a photograph that was taken in the past, obviously,
mm-hmm.
or daydreaming about something that's about to happen or could happen. I've never experienced a day in my life where there weren't multiple voices. I don't know anybody other than maybe a hermit who could say that, who would say otherwise. And we've come to think of minimalistic style writing or just like having a single narrator and a single time sequence going from A to Z as being the sort of de facto way that books are written, and that anything else is the intrusion of style.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think of the way that I write as being the absolute most simple way to say what I want to say. I never apply things in the interest of style or in the interest of, I don't know, a book feeling different or a book being experimental. Not at all. I don't care about those things. I care about directness. And this is my way of being as unstylized as I can, actually.
Really? So invention is sort of a matter of course with you, then, you would say, in terms of, like, you know, introducing, like, you know, text that sort of blurs into each other, visual elements and things like that.
You know, I guess I've been surprised how often that's come up as a topic of how often readers mention that or ask questions about it, because when I wrote it, I didn't feel so differently than I did writing any other page of the book. I think, you know, the novel is such a conservative art form in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
If I were a painter and there were text in my painting, you would never ask me about it. Nobody would ask me about it because we're used to it. People have been putting text in paintings for literally hundreds of years, thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
thousands of years, Japanese scroll paintings. But when a writer brings an image into a book, it's a noteworthy thing. It's a curious thing. It demands an explanation. And I think it just points to how conservative the form has been.
Well, only recently comics and graphic novels, which are very visual, are now sort of actually being considered as literature. So
right.
there, I guess, is an expectation of some degree that a novel should contain words, damn it, and, you know, nothing but the words.
Right.
Any deviation, I guess, from the standard kind of, you know, procedure, standard operating procedure is, you know, I mean, even now, you know, I guess, what are your thoughts on sort of like the, you know, currently the favored critics would probably be like B.R. Myers or James Wood or even Sven Burkitt, although he's a little bit postmodern happy. But, you know, essentially we have a critical environment that, for something that you do, is going to be sort of almost anathema to that, not necessarily going to recognize that.
Well, to be honest, I don't really follow literary criticism very closely. I read the New York Times, I read the New Republic. I can't help but, you know, see reviews occasionally, and it's not like I avoid them.
Yeah.
But I don't seek them out, and I don't have the faintest clue what those people you mentioned are writing about in any given moment. James Wood, maybe more than the others, but you know, they do something, writers do something, and readers do something. And sometimes those somethings overlap in an interesting way, mm-hmm. and sometimes they don't touch one another, and sometimes they overlap in an uninteresting way. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not the business of a writer to think about what is popular or anathema in a given moment, what is considered interesting, what's considered boring. It's, you write what you have to write, and you're extremely lucky if that, for whatever reason, resonates with people, mm-hmm. whether they're reviewers or whether they're book buyers, you know, and readers. But lucky is about as much value as you can put on it. It has nothing to do with why you make what you make.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you've just described to me that there is a sort of conscious restraint on your part to sort of quell the level of invention in your books, in the sense that, you know, what you see in your two novels so far is essentially kind of a minimum of invention. Maybe you could describe this a little bit. You know, what restraints are you placing upon yourself, or why are you trying to whack things down further, or what's...
No,
what's...
no, I don't. I actually, maybe I misspoke.
Okay.
I don't put any restraints on myself. I just mean the only thing I'm interested in is saying what I want to say as directly as I can.
Okay.
I hope books are inventive. Invention, you know, the lives we create for ourselves are inventions. Reading, it involves so much invention on the reader's part. Forget about the writer's part. Invention is the project of literature, so it's not something I would shy away from. All I mean is, I don't do it. I don't invent or write with style for any reason other than I feel like it's the most forceful way to express what it is that I want to express.
But do you sort of like place a justification behind the invention? Because some of your critics have kind of sort of said, hey, you know, this Jonathan Safran Foer kid, he's just like, you know, totally filling up the pages with pictures, and they don't necessarily serve a sort of explicit kind of point. I mean, I think there was the John Updike review, which he said about Extremely Loud, the book's hyperactive visual surface covers up a certain hollow monotony in its verbal drama. Do you feel like the visual invention gets in the way of, you know, telling a message verbally, or?
Well, I mean, obviously I don't. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it that way. But I don't think he's wrong either. I think he has an opinion. And nobody's ever proven right or wrong with books. You know, if somebody hates Kafka, I can disagree till the end of time, but I can't prove them wrong. So it's inevitable that people will think something works or doesn't work, and that... the author's kind of stuck in the middle. I did it because I made the book look the way that it does, because I thought it was the way the book should look. You know, I thought it was the best way to tell this particular story. Some people think I was right. Some people think I was wrong. You know.
Did you design this book in Quark or?
No, actually, in Word.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it was a kind of slop. It was not smart computing. Very awkward. And there were times when I just made a little note that said, this should look like such and such here. This image should be inserted in this such and such way here.
Wow. So, I mean, that must have wrecked havoc in terms of, like, the image size for, like, you know, the actual... If you were just taking a file that you found off of the web...
It was a big-ass file.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to talk about, actually... Since we're on the subject of sort of like, you know, style, there's the section Why I'm Not Where You Are in this book, which is sort of, you know, one might argue that you have all these red marks that sort of correct the mistakes, and yet it's sort of getting in the way of the actual text itself, which is trying to sort of tell this really sort of heartfelt kind of story. You know, and it almost gets in the way of sort of experiencing it. I mean, I something like that seems, you know, very sort of conceptual, but at the same time, you know, how can that be sort of literature, or do you think this is going to affect the reader's perception and get in the way of perhaps sort of accessing the message behind the red marks?
Well, I hope it will influence the reader's perception, otherwise I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
I think there are two things going on simultaneously. One is the story that this grandfather character is narrating. The other is the story that's being told through these markings. And they're literally overlapping stories. And I hope that each is emotional in its own way. And I think they do get in the way of each other. But that's how stories work in life. They get in the way of each other. You know, the ways that a son interprets his father's story, the ways that a son tries to correct his father's stories,
yeah,
gets in the way of the father's stories.
Yeah.
And a novel should be no more simple or pretty than, you know, life is.
I guess, though, did you sort of, like, place the red marks there in a deliberate effort to be difficult, or in a way to challenge or provoke? Or I'm curious about this.
No, not to be difficult. To be... I put them there to tell the story as I thought the story should be told. And if it had to be difficult, that's okay. That's different than... You know, to put something somewhere knowing that it will be difficult is different than putting it there in the interest of being difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think I put it there... Yeah, of course I noticed that it wasn't what most books look like, but that wasn't why I did it. I did it because it felt like the way to express this part of the story.
It was more of an instinctive choice then, you would say.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, what about the issue of... You actually sort of... some degree popped the September 11th cherry by actually writing a novel about it. Now, also, you know, Jay McInerney recently noted he wrote also a novel about September 11th, and he had pointed out that Norman Mailer suggested to him that he should wait 10 years before writing about this. I wanted to ask, why write about something that's so close to memory? Do you feel that you're sort of going to, you know, almost kind of preclude your sort of perspective or your ability to sort of take in things because we're too close, and particularly since, you know, we were given all manner of CNN imagery, and we were given all manner of, like, you know, it was very copiously reported too, so that sort of also kind of influences things. I guess, how do you feel that, you know, what are your thoughts on writing about sort of like a major kind of tragedy, so to speak, you know, so close to public memory?
There's this idea that we have to understand something or have moved past it or come to terms with it before we should write about it. I don't know that anybody will ever come to terms with what happened. That doesn't make sense to me. There's no such thing as closure in life. Death is closure in life. Short of that, we just keep changing the ways that we feel about things. And there's something to be said for an immediate response. And by the way, if something that comes 4 years after is not an immediate response. You know.
Well, by some token it is. Some people might argue that.
I think it's people who look at art in a certain way. You know, I wonder if those people would ask journalists if it was too soon to cover September 11th on September 11th.
Yeah.
I wonder if those people would ask, you know, imagine a journalist who didn't cover September 11th. Wouldn't we find that peculiar? Wouldn't we think that that person was negligent?
Yeah.
Wouldn't we stop paying attention to that person? I think that writers have a lot of the same instincts that journalists do. They want to grapple with the events that shape our lives. Writers can do it in a lot of different ways. Journalists tend to do it more or less in one way, which is explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Arthur Miller can write about McCarthyism by writing about the Salem witch trials. I chose to write about this in a straightforward way, in a very explicit way. And I'm sure that my feelings about the event will be different in a year or two. But that has nothing to do with whether or not I should have written the book as I did. Maybe I should write another book about it in a year or two. Or maybe I should just be ashamed of the book I wrote in a year or two. The point of books isn't to be definitive.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the opposite. It's to be open. It's to write something that can whose meaning can change over time as our understandings of the subject change over time. So I guess that wasn't something that had occurred to me.
But at the same time, you know, I mean, looking at an incident close, looking at an incident, you know, years later, will have two completely different perspectives. I'm not certain if, I mean, you know, granted, yes, I will agree with you that, you know, right now there's this big hoopla over the movie Flight 93 where, oh, we can't release a movie right now because it's just too close, so to speak, but even though it's like 5 years later. On one hand, you have a situation where, you know, why censor ourselves? Why deny the fact that things happen? You know, we should probably write about these. And on the other hand, it's, you know, looking at a sort of, you know, through something through either an oblique slant like Miller or having sort of like 10 years to kind of masticate upon the, you know, the actual event. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for both sides. So where is the gray area that you sort of fit in with this?
I actually don't think there's anything to be said for the other side. I think what we could say is, I think there's anything to be said for waiting for the sake of waiting. Mm-hmm. I think what we can say is after somebody's written about it or made a movie about it, we can say it was a failure. Mm-hmm. But that's a totally different issue, mm-hmm. you know? What's strange is a lot of people are evaluating these decisions before the work of art is made.
Yeah.
People have opinions on United 93 without having seen it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a terrible movie, so let's watch it and say it's terrible. Let's talk about it. But to decide in advance that it's too soon to make it, who knows? Maybe the filmmaker's a genius.
Yeah.
Maybe he has created a story that will change my thinking of the event, shape my thinking of the events in a way that I've been longing for. Mm-hmm. So I think these are questions that should be coming after we look at the work. If Norman Mailer looks at McInerney's work and says this was a failure, that's okay.
Yeah.
You can say that.
Yeah.
But to say in advance you shouldn't try it, I'm not sure I can understand that.
Hmm. So it's really, why do you think with your books, I mean, you've also sort of been, you know, you've been named like the New York Press. The New York Press is really on your ass because they like named you one of the most loathsome New Yorkers. And there was, of course, the Harry Siegel review. But why do you think that in your case they're really sort of, you know, really after you? They really was like, you know, it seems to me that it's a little bit more than just the fact, the whole young, successful angle. It seems to me that there's something a little bit more, it's almost as if they're taken aback by your sort of stylistic or, you know, what might be viewed sort of experimental or even sort of like what we're talking about now, which is like, you know, go ahead and let's put the novel out there and let's judge after it rather than before.
To be honest, I'd never even heard of the New York Press until somebody mentioned that I was on this list, which I thought was about the funniest thing that had ever happened, and frankly, one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I have no idea. I don't know. I'm not the kind of person who would make a list of... What is it?
It's the most loathsome New Yorkers.
Yeah. I wouldn't make such a list. I don't think I would read such a list. So it's hard to wonder about it or to make any guess about what it means. You know, the kinds of things that I'm interested in aren't those. So I don't know.
But to a certain degree also, like, the way that people write about you is going to inevitably sort of influence the way they look at your novels. Like the infamous Deborah Solomon profile. You come across, and I don't know, I only have Solomon's perspective to go by, but you come across as this sort of chronic emailer to her. And, you know.
Yeah, that was funny. That was funny.
Do you just use email a lot, or
uses email a lot. You know, every interview is as much about the interviewer as the interviewee. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you read something like an interview or a profile, I hope most people enter into it with that knowledge. I guess in different interviews, I come off very, very differently. You know, sometimes I come off as like this earnest person. Sometimes I come off as an asshole. Sometimes I come off as someone who doesn't seem to care. Sometimes I come off as someone who seems to care too much. And it's just maybe the average of all of them is accurate. You know, but
or
it's
you're
like,
just the Lon Chaney of literature.
Yeah, right.
But at the same time, though, I mean, like, I guess to get off the personality sort of angle, but I mean, this is going to affect how people sort of approach your work. This is going to affect, like, you know, I don't know, it just seems that they're more inordinately sort of concerned with your personal details than actually sort of discussing the work and trying to sort of contextualize it. And then also what's even more bizarre is that you have all these passionate defenses as well. Like, you've got Pauline Millard and even Mark Sarvis of The Elegant Variation just, you know, came to your defense. And so there's this very strange kind of, like, you know, take Jonathan down, you know, defend Jonathan, as opposed to like, well, what about the work? What about the books, you know?
I actually think it is about the work. I think that that's a conversation that exists in its own sphere, mm-hmm. but it's not the real conversation that happens with books. You know, books happen on a, if you're lucky, a relatively large scale. And, you know, like the readings that I do, I don't think anybody who comes to them has ever heard of the New York Press, for example. I don't think it's on their radar. And I think each of us has a test for whether or not a book is good, our own test of authenticity. And if a book passes your test, I think you forget about everything else. Everything else. And if it doesn't pass your test, you forget about everything else. You know, the best person in the world, who I most admire, who's gotten the best reviews. You read that person's book and it doesn't engage you, and it's not going to engage you. Nothing will persuade you. And I've read books by, you know, I like Wagner's music. And this is the classic case of, like, a person you can't stomach whose music you worship.
Yeah.
And nothing will convince me otherwise. He's a genius composer.
Sure.
So I'm just not worried about it. It's not the real conversation.
I know you don't worry about this, but I mean, it just seems though it's just an inordinate case of people sort of like, you know, dwelling upon these details as opposed to, like, you know, discussing your work or discussing what sort of makes your work tick or discussing, oh, well, I'm looking at this book, you know, extremely loud, and I'm seeing that it's using postmodern elements in a way that, you know, is almost defiantly sort of out of fashion, you know?
I think I'm also maybe not so aware of the conversation you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well,
I don't, believe it or not, I don't use the internet that much. And I certainly don't look around to see what people are saying about me. So the most I sort of pick up on it is when I hear about it. But I don't have any first-hand experience with it. So it's not just, I just don't know what it is. I don't really know what the reality is. I know it couldn't be helpful to me. As a writer, you know.
Sure. Well, let's get off that subject entirely. I wanted to actually talk about the Mr. Black character, specifically the one who was born on January 1st, 1900. Mm. And I was wondering if this was kind of possibly influenced by, I'm not sure if you've read Anthony Burgess's really great book, Earthly Powers.
I haven't, actually.
It's really, really good, but it's sort of like basically this guy, he's an 82-year-old commercial novelist, and he's lived his entire life, much like Zelig, sort of a couple of years later, you know, in terms of, like, you know, he loses his virginity when James Joyce starts writing Ulysses, things like that. But also, I was wondering what the sort of inspiration for this, or maybe I was also thinking Bertolucci's 1900 with Gerard Depardieu and Robert De Niro, both born on the same day, January 1st, 1900. Or this character seemed to stand out, and I was wondering if you could sort of describe how this particular character came to be, what was the sort of. And it's also a bit on the conceptual side, too, which is interesting. So,
I actually knew somebody who's amazingly similar, a guy named Robert St. John. Mm-hmm. He was a biographer. Mm-hmm. He did the biographies of a lot of the leading Middle East politicians. Mm-hmm. I guess his biography of Ben-Gurion is probably his most famous. And he died at the age, I believe, of 103. And he had fought in both world wars. He had dated Hemingway's sister, I think.
Really?
In the book, it's Fitzgerald's sister.
Yeah.
And when I wrote, I just imagined him. It was pretty much that simple. I did end up writing, though, the whole scene around the image in the book. I think it's on page 167 and 168, if I'm not mistaken. It's a spread of birds over two pages.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I recall that.
And I had found that image first and written basically the entire chapter around it. It's a sort of long story, but I put together a book about Joseph Cornell when I was a while ago, anyway. And I was paid, by and large, just by being able to get books from the publisher. And so they still send me catalogs every season. And I go through it and I say which books I want to, you know, pay off the debt with.
Yeah.
And that image was the cover of one of the books.
Huh.
It's a book called, I think it was called The Birdman of Brooklyn. And it was a German a Swiss photographer, Marion Mueller. Mm-hmm. And I just found it so evocative. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I ended up tracking her down. The book was never published, her book. It
really?
Just sort of fell apart at the last minute. I tracked her down. I got to look at a lot of her images, and I ended up writing about it.
Are you, were a lot of the sections of Extremely Loud sort of inspired by photos in the background that you sort of like used to kind of almost focus your energies on writing? Or?
Sometimes the photos came after the words. It happened very organically. It never, there was no obvious way that it always happened.
So, were there any other sections that were sort of inspired by specific photos, or did the, which came first in some sections, the photos or
right.
the text?
Let me think.
The chicken or the egg? What is the chicken or the egg?
Right. I can't even remember. Like, for example, the falling body at the end. I don't remember if I had the idea to reverse the images first and then write about it, or if I wrote about it and then it just felt like one. Like it was, they weren't separate ideas that I paired together. They were the same idea.
Did you, you mentioned that you were working on this in Word. I was wondering, it seems to me that it was put together. I got the sense when reading it that it was sort of very kind of organic or like hand put together at some point. You almost have to, like when you're dealing with like juxtaposing text and images and also specific sort of like pages.
Right.
You know, I'm wondering, did you do this all entirely on the computer or did you have to lay things out? Or
I did it entirely on the computer.
Really?
Once it was going to go to the printer, there was someone at the publishing house who was, you know, proficient with whatever program. I think it was Quark. Mm-hmm. And who helped me do it then. But I kind of just did a crude simulation, you know, in Word. And that was how I turned the manuscript in.
Huh. Wow. I wanted to talk about, like, well, the numbers that are throughout this work. There's, for example, the telephone messages that Oscar's dad leaves. There's the one section where it's just nothing but sort of like the equation. Why do these numbers serve as any sort of point of significance to the reader? Is there anything that might sort of adduce his or her understanding of the is there anything for numerologists here?
I don't know any numerologists or Scientologists for that matter, or gynecologists for that matter.
It's safe to say that ologists just aren't, you know, happening in your world right
exactly
now.
Actually, there probably are a couple. Let's think here. Anyway, I don't know. There's so many characters in this book, and in my first book, are people who don't communicate very well. They can't say what they need to say when they need to say it. Alex in my first book is a caricatured example. He just doesn't speak English very well.
Yeah.
And in this book, you know, there's a character who's mute. Oscar can speak endlessly to strangers, but has a very hard time communicating with people close to him. The grandmother thinks she's typing everything, is typing nothing. So, but there are people who keep trying to communicate, and they use any tools at their disposal. Sometimes it's sign language. Sometimes it's writing on the body or on architecture. Sometimes it's, you know, giving various signals from a distance, throwing paper airplanes with notes written on them. And the book, I think, echoes that. There's like a desperation in the book to communicate. I didn't ever want it to feel elegant. I wanted it to feel desperate. Like you're just reaching for anything that might possibly help express the message that you need to express. And those numbers are an almost a jokey example of it, but a very like explicit example of it. If words won't work, then maybe numbers will work.
Gotcha.
But of course they don't work. You know.
Well, there's also the section in your first book where it's just like the endless sort of same word over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, we are writing over and over.
Yeah,
that's a little bit different. That was a little different. That was more an expression of this like irrepressible will to remember.
Yeah,
which is similar but a little different.
Both of your books sort of are quest tales to some degree. Quest tales set against some sort of really terrible, sort of ominous thing, the Holocaust, September 11th. And also both involve grandparents. And I was wondering, what sort of attracts you to this kind of, what attracted you to this similar kind of template for the second book?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It wasn't the template I had when I started writing. I thought I was writing a very different book. Mm-hmm. And I just found myself writing this book. I guess I must be looking for something. I don't know. I mean, that's what a That's the easy answer, right?
I suppose.
There are other easy answers too, which I hope aren't correct. Like, I don't know how to write any other kind of book, so I just slip into this form, or it's a convenient form, or it's an easy form. I don't think that's why I did it, but it might be. Yeah. You know the old saying, a bird is not an ornithologist? You know, just because you are something doesn't mean you can explain why you are or would choose to be what you are. Sometimes that's how I feel. And I'm not exactly sure why I wrote this way. I can say that having written two books that, of course, do resonate like that, I now won't write a third one like that. Now it's something that I really am conscious of and feel like I'll have more control over the process.
But there's also, you amped up the invention a little bit with the second one. So I was wondering, what kind of, you know, did you feel more comfortable to sort of throw photos and stylistic things in there? Or was it just a natural kind of, you know, you were moving from first gear to second gear? Or?
I don't think it's first gear to second gear. I think clearly they're different gears, but I don't think that one is bigger than the other, more powerful than the other. I wasn't aware of any kind of progression between the two books in terms of style. It was just the way I did it.
What about also like the there were a lot of repetitive phrases throughout this, and also the one that seems to stick out for me is the sort of the Stephen Hawking boilerplate letter to Oscar. How did you decide upon Hawking and that particular sort of, you know, boilerplate, you know, for some reason until that day always sort of stuck out for whatever reason. It just seemed a very weird way to end a sort of boilerplate sort of email. Right. But it seemed also particularly sort of Hawking-ian or whatever.
Hawking-like,
yes. Hawking-ian.
Uh-huh. It just seemed like the person Oscar would write to. I mean, you know, it's funny, when I write, it's like there are two ways to observe a city. You can walk through the whole city, or you can go to the highest building and look down on the city. Mm-hmm. When I write a book, I walk through the book. I don't feel like I step away from it and say, okay, now who would be good for Oscar to write to? Who would be interesting? Who would like play off of this theme? Who would advance the plot in this way? It's much more that in the experience of writing the book and creating Oscar, it was obvious that it couldn't have been another way, I felt. You know, there's an inevitability, I guess, about the ways the characters develop. Mm-hmm. And Hawking just struck me as right.
So you just basically write this thing on total instinct, no plotting or outline?
Yeah, but I didn't edit it on instinct. Mm. I mean, editing is a different process.
Yeah.
And I edited it. That is one of the hardest two words to say together, edited in the past tense.
Just like Hawking-ing.
Yeah, I edited it. Editing is really deliberate and self-conscious and hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, writing is hard too. It's hard in a different way. It's much more choosing against things rather than choosing not to choose against things.
Let's see.
God, doesn't Billy Joel suck?
Well, actually, in his younger years, I'll give him the Billy Joel of my life was actually, you know, pretty. That's a pretty caustic song, but everything after that is right. Just, you know, when he right about the time when he married Christine Brinkley, yes, I think that's where we went downhill.
Take a lesson.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk also about this sort of element of placing your sort of narratives in the form of like a tremendously terrible sort of thing. We didn't quite get into that in the sense of why the Holocaust or why September 11th. You know, are you sort of one of those like naturally kind of apocalyptic type of people, or what's the situation?
There's probably a part of me that's that way, but in the case of the first book, it was so much a part of my family's history, so much a part of the stories we told, or I was told, and more of the stories I wasn't told. I can't imagine having written a first book about something else. I really can't. In the case of the second book, it was so much a part of my experience at the time. I mean, such a large proportion of my thoughts and feelings had to do with September 11th. It's hard to imagine a New Yorker who wouldn't say that. I guess I have a harder time than most disconnecting my writing. from whatever I'm thinking about and feeling in a given moment. So right now I don't have anything like that. You know, there isn't that glaring, that elephant in the room.
Well, it's also interesting, too, because it's almost like you place down this, like, really serious sort of onyx baseboard, right? That you've got to, like, you know, sort of, you know, put a whole bunch of, like, white sort of, you know, little comical sort of dots upon, I would say. It's almost as if, I don't know, I mean, it seems to me that you've almost kind of created this sort of, it's almost like you're rebelling against, you know, laughing in the face, or rather, you know, you can't laugh in the face of tragedy, but oh, yes, you can. You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe you could describe something.
I don't laugh in the face of tragedy. I suppose one could.
Yeah.
I don't. People say you wrote a humorous book about the Holocaust. I wasn't humorous about the Holocaust. The book contained moments of humor, and it contained moments that had to do with the Holocaust. They didn't really happen at the same time. It's not because I don't think they could. I suppose they could. But it's just not what I did. And in this book, you know, Oscar's a kid with a lot of grief.
Yeah.
He's also a kid who's very funny, I hope. Again, I think they happened at different times in the book. And that to me just seems true, you know. Have you ever had a month or a year when there weren't moments of humor and moments of tragedy? You know, yeah. I doubt it.
I mean, well, at the same time, though, it's like life isn't just one or the other. It's just a number of gray areas. But I also wanted to ask, why focus on a child protagonist this time, as opposed to a sort of, not really a kind of a semi-meta kind of situation with the first one?
Well, he's a particular kind of child. I mean, he's not.
Yeah.
There aren't children who could narrate a book like this in the way that he does. He's more like the idea of a child. He's not a realistic character. I thought that he was a good vehicle for a lot of energy, first of all. Also, I thought the distance between him and the reader, between him and me, was something that was really could be very powerful. You know, being aware of things that he's not aware of. Maybe even having a desire to protect him from certain things. Again, it makes the reader complicit in a way that having a peer as a narrator couldn't. It also had a lot of drawbacks. You know, there are ways in which he can't be articulate. There are ways in which his inexperience is really limiting. But you have to choose.
Well, it's interesting, too, though, that, you know, one thing you didn't mention in these list of advantages and disadvantages is purity. How a child will often sort of view a situation in a completely fresh and different way. And certainly, given the fact that Oscar is constantly sort of inventing things, to what extent was purity a factor in sort of, I guess, coming to terms with his grief or exploring his grief on the pages of this book?
I don't think children are pure. I think they're inexperienced. Pure. I mean, the way we think about human purity implies a kind of will. Like, one is pure when one doesn't transgress, or one is pure when one has cleansed oneself. It's not the same as talking about pure water, you know, where water from the springs of Avion is pure. With a human, purity, at least for me, implies there was once impurity. I don't think children are. Sometimes we make a mistake of assuming too much of children, in saying that they are confusing inexperience for wisdom, you know, and it's dangerous.
You say this also as a recent father, I should point out.
Well, there's no question that my son is not wise. I mean, you know, if he was so wise, why doesn't he go to the bathroom and the toilet? Actually, I guess if I'm so wise, why do I go to the bathroom and the toilet? I guess I didn't think about purity, but naivete maybe, you know, and that is useful because he will say things that an adult wouldn't say because it's inappropriate or because because they're scared, because they're self-conscious.
Gotcha. The other thing I want to talk about, and going back to this issue of the visual versus the verbal, is there's the moment where Oscar tells his mother that, you know, he wishes that she would have been the one to have died rather than her father. And it's one of those moments that sort of like, you know, I guess I wanted to sort of talk about sort of like, you know, a moment that is captured visually versus a moment that is captured verbally. Did you sort of, again, it seems to me that this book sort of came out in the kind of one sort of instinctive kind of mad rush, it sounds like. But in terms of sort of thinking about like that particular moment, I mean, you know, do you feel I don't know, that moment sort of stands alone on the page, yet at the same time, if it were like, you know, represented in a pictorial fashion, maybe it wouldn't have the sort of same effect. Was this kind of, maybe you could describe some of the kind of the planned impulse, or how much was the sort of, I guess, reader's response, which we talked about a little bit earlier, sort of factoring into whether you pursued something visually or verbally?
I don't remember the expression you used, a mad, whatever it was.
Oh, mad rush, I think.
Yeah, that wasn't how it was. A lot of the writing I was trying to say was very intuitive, but then the editing process was so deliberate that in the end, nothing happened by accident. You know, it really was because I made a choice that this is how it should be. And in that case, it would have had a very different effect if there were an image. And it wasn't the effect that I desired. When I used an image, it was because it was the effect that I desired. It's a little bit hard to describe it any more than that. It's not that I imagine a specific reader. It's that as a reader of my own writing, you know, I try to be a reader rather than a writer when I write. I don't want to write something that I think would be good to write. I want to write something that I know is good to read for me, which sometimes corresponds to what's good for other people and sometimes doesn't. And so in that scene, the way that I wanted to read it was without anything else.
Gotcha. We got to wrap this up very soon, but I wanted to talk also about like the other media that you work in. You've got on your website the Project Museum, and also recently you made a video in which you asserted that sort of current slaughtering practices aren't exactly kosher, and I wanted to sort of see, do you find this kind of feeds in or inspires your writing, or why these other elements of like cabs moving backward, or lists of books and the like on the website, and on one hand a sort of kind of political sort of video of some kind. Does it channel sort of certain impulses that you can't explore in your writing, or given also that we've sort of talked about like that, you know, what you write is a little different from the norm in terms of like, you know, the traditional novels in a sort of kind of conservative publishing environment?
Well, there's a time and place for everything, and the things that you share hopefully are a small fraction of the things that you are, you know. So some of my creative or political impulses I share, like books or like that video, but there are many more that I don't share. And so in a way, the things that you do share become misrepresentative. I've written two books, but there are a million books I wish I'd written or that I've thought of. Maybe I haven't actually thought of them, but I wish I'd thought of. And so you write two books and it speaks something about you. This is somebody who's written about two large historical calamities. He's somebody who must think about historical calamities a lot. Well, some, but it's not who I am. I think about a lot of other things too. These are the two books that I've written. But there's a certain way that I cook meals at home. There's a certain way that I talk to my friends. There's a certain way that I arrange things in the room that I work in. There's a certain way that I, you know, there are a million creative acts that everyone partakes in every day. And I don't think of myself as somebody who is pointing all his arrows at writing. You know, I never wanted to be a writer exactly. I wanted for making things to be a large part of my life. And I feel that it is. The largest thing that I make, the most of the making is books, but some of the making is that video. Some of the making is that website. Some of the making are things that I would never show to anybody. They're no less important to me, and I'm no less, you know, proud or ashamed of them. I think I never want to be somebody who is only what he shares with others. I guess that's what I mean.
Okay. Well, I have to go, unfortunately, but Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow.